Our PowerPoint is not working this morning, and I appreciate Rick worked on it a lot yesterday. I could show you my PowerPoint presentation. There it is right there. So that's about as much of it as you're going to get today. So apparently we had some lightning run in, perhaps, or something that's messed it up. So, but anyway, we'll do the best we can. But the lesson kind of did have a lot of pictures and things on it that related to the lesson, but I'll do my best to convey what it is that I had wanted to say. I actually did kind of a series. I guess if I was to lay on a psychiatrist's couch and had expressed to him my problem, I would say, well, doctor, I have a problem. I keep preaching on the same subject over and over and over again. And so here it is again today. Looking behind a persistent theme of the devil's schemes to deceive the masses. That's what I've entitled this. And parts of what you're going to hear was in a class that I did last year, and there was just a handful of people here at that time, and it was not that many people heard it, so I thought it was worth revisiting. And also I added some other stuff to it, and I'll be presenting that both this morning and tonight. When Jesus and his disciples were in Caesarea Philippi, you'll remember there in Matthew 16, where he asked his disciples, says, "Who do men say that I am?" And they answer and say, "Well, Elijah or John the Baptist or Jeremiah or one of the prophets." And then he asked the more personal question. He said, "But who do you say that I am?" And the answer, of course, that Peter gave there is, "Thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God." And Jesus said, "Upon this rock I will build my church." That is the rock that his deity, his sonship, his being the anointed one, the Messiah, is the rock upon which the church would be built. Now, what I want to relate this to at this point, though, is the place in which that was said, because it's important to the rest of the lesson. The place that it was said was Caesarea Philippi, and the most remarkable feature of Caesarea Philippi was the temple of Pan. And the disciples were either well known in the area, and they could have been inside of it very easily. And we're going to get back to that, regarding the Temple of Pan. But what I want to do this morning is draw a contrast between the Temple of Pan and other idols throughout history, and the rock of our salvation, Christ Jesus. What I would like to do is show you a consistent and persistent theme of the devil that he has now used for thousands of years to distract and persuade man of different ideas related to who God is. And finally, in this generation, in your generation, in my generation, the people who are living today are seeing the largest acceptance of the greater population of the world to his deceptive suggestion that mankind has bought hook, line, and sinker. But first, let me go back thousands of years to the earliest known idols. And I want to describe those earliest known idols to you. I had a PowerPoint presentation that had pictures of all of these. But again, I could show that to you, but that wouldn't do you all that much good. But archaeology records have shown us pictures of many of the idols that have been worshipped through the years back to the earliest times. And the earliest times would have been the Egyptians, for example. The Egyptians had and what I want you to do while I'm talking about these is, what you should be thinking is, what do all of these idols have in common? Thoth was the bird man god. Anubis was the dog man god. Those are two Egyptian idols. You'll remember the Philistine idol named Dagon. And that was, Dagon was the one who, when the Philistines captured the Ark of the Covenant and put him in the temple of Dagon, and God thumped him over in the night and broke off his head and hand, that was Dagon. Dagon is the seed fish man god. And if you look up Google images, Dagon, it's all the same image pretty much, which is half fish and half man. Molech, or Baal, is illustrated and found archaeologically. The same thing is almost always a half bull, half man. Then we come to Pan, which you've already mentioned. What was Pan? Pan was half goat, half man. And then if we were to look at Hinduism, Hinduism has a plethora of animal slash man images, elephant's head on men's bodies. One of them that I would point out now is Hanuman, which is a man's figure with a monkey's head or monkey's face. So, okay, what do all these images, what do all these idols have in common? Well, everybody here could tell me what that was, and that is, they are half one thing and half another. They are morphic images. They are animal parts that are put on human bodies and created an idol out of that image. Of course, the Romans and the Greeks had many gods. Most of their gods actually had human form. But many of the ancient forms of the ancient world were half man and half animal parts. So the well-defined identities that have been combined and confused and mixed is part of what the devil has been introducing into the mind of man, willing accomplices, into our thinking. Half one thing and half another. Whereas the creature is no longer a fish or a fowl, a peacock or whatever, or an elephant, but rather different things mixed in to God's beautiful order. All of nature, I've probably mentioned this before, has a stylistic uniformity to it. We are not just man, we are all man. If you were to take an oak tree, for example, the leaf is an oak, the acorn is oak, the wood is oak, the bark is oak, everything about the oak tree is oak. If you were to take a peacock, you could take one feather out of the peacock and say, this is a peacock feather. So he's peacock from his head to his tail. Everything in God's creation is that way. There is a stylistic uniformity to all of God's creation. This establishes the order, a design order that is part of God's signature. It is what he, it is part of who he is. The devil is the great deceiver. He is the father of lies. Lies originate with him. Deception has been his motivating factor and the part of his character that is sustains him, apparently. And his success is dependent on his ability to deceive. He loves a lie. He loves deception. He loves deceiving human beings. He also has the advantage of existing through generations of mankind, through thousands and thousands of years. And because of that, he has the ability to develop a theme over time. And that theme can be built upon through thousands of years when he has willing partners that want to believe a lie. Alternative images and ideas are his stock and trade. The devil has been pushing the deception of morphism since the beginning of time and creation to confuse and distort the order and distinctive qualities of creation. Let me read you from the Bible just a little passage here that relates to our subject this morning. This is in 1 Corinthians 15, verses 38 and 39. It says, "But God gives it a body as he pleases, and to each seed its own body. All flesh is not the same flesh, but there is one kind of flesh of men, another flesh of animals, another of fish, and another of birds." And we could read on there, but the point that's being made is that there are distinctive qualities between the things that God has created. They are not morphed together. They are distinctive. So God is understood by the things which he has made, according to Romans 1. Invisible things of him from the creation of the world are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. Human beings are without excuse when it comes to believing in God. They are without excuse. But the confusion and disorder of God's creation leads to innumerable wrong-headed ideas and concepts that lead mankind to forget who his real father is and lose his identity as the being created in the image of God. And in that rejection of God, he does not retain the knowledge of God and of his law and his revelation, God's word, and no longer therefore seeks the singular truth, the standard of God's word. And in exchange, he embraces innumerable individual ideas introduced by morphism, shape-shifting, transitional forms, and who minimize the differences and exaggerate the similarities in order to suggest that there is no real design to all of creation. Nothing intentional, only the seeming appearance of design that is in a constant state of change and exchange. Half one thing and half another. Body parts that are interchangeable. This has been, as I say, the long-term strategy of the devil for thousands of years across generations of humans, not just 1859, when Darwin wrote his Origin of Species. A grand deception, and one that has met with its greatest success in terms of numbers of people in your generation that accept it and approve it, that believe it that humans have morphed into our present state from other forms millions of years ago, or through millions of years. And we have changed and shapeshift and transitioned from one species to another over millions of years. The last number that I have that I looked up regarding American beliefs is this: 15 to 26% of Americans believe in a literal six-day creation as recorded in the Bible. 15 to 26%. That's the information that I last looked up, if that's accurate. Those would be known generally as young earth creationists. The lies of the devil are constantly being fine-tuned to be accepted by each new generation. They morph, they change, they transition. That is the character of lies. They're never the same. By contrast, of course, Jesus Christ is the same yesterday, today, and forever. That's Hebrews 13:8. His truths are immutable. His standards are immutable. God is immutable. And the dictionary, if you think about his counsel is immutable, it says in Hebrews 6. If you think about the word mutable or immutable, the opposite of immutable is mutable. But what does mutable mean? Well, the different dictionary definition of mutable is subject to change or alteration, changeable, variable, unstable, wavering, unsteady. Those are dictionary definitions of the word mutable. God is the opposite of that. He is immutable. So to mutate is to change, to undergo mutation. Isn't it interesting? I found it this very interesting, and I haven't heard anybody else say this. Maybe they have, probably have. But I think it's very interesting and instructive to realize that the very word that embodies the character of God, immutable, and the opposite word, mutable, is the very proposed mechanism for evolution, mutation, changing, constant flux, morphing from one form to another, and thus the introduction of confusion. Darwinism is no better than any of the ancient pagan earth religions that feature man-made idol gods out of morphed images. The only real difference is that one is called idol worship and the other is called science. But at the core of each is a lie of the devil, that things can morph from one thing to another. Darwinism is the largest pagan cult to ever exist on earth, believed by more people than have ever existed on earth, close to about 8 billion people now. And not all of those believe in evolution, but a large percentage of them do. There are two different aspects of morphism have resulted in two different ways of viewing the world and mankind's place in it. The idol worship aspect is mostly the ancient world, but not exclusively. Fits the Romans 1 model, as we have talked about before. That is, they change the glory of God into an image made like to corruptible man and four-footed beast and creeping things. And they worshiped and served the creature rather than the creator. That very well sums up the one side of the ancient world of morphic gods, such as we have talked about. The popular and modern view of morphism, better known as evolution, rather than giving credit to a different God, seeks to eliminate the need for any God and assumes an entirely materialistic and purely naturalistic explanation of the universe and life on Earth, resulting in the decrease in the minds of man, the notion that he has a special position in creation. Because if we are animals, if we came from fish, then we have no special position in creation. We're simply one of many animals on Earth. So that means that our value is diminished and we become sort of an intruder on Earth and its inhabitants, and you know, we're destroying the Earth, and there's an excessive attention to endangered species and environment, things such as that, while at the same time we kill our own offspring. That just shows you where things have come to on the Earth we're living on at this time, that the world has become more important than the humans that live on it. And you know, abortion is like close to 1 million a year. Fortunately, it's coming down, but one child that is killed intentionally is one too many. These kinds of attitudes that we all see in the world today are the consequences of eliminating the God of the Bible from our knowledge. And when you get rid of the Creator, you get rid of design. When you get rid of design, you get rid of purpose. If there's no design, then there can be no purpose to anything. If you get rid of purpose, then you get rid of accountability. If you get rid of accountability, then you get rid yourself of responsibility. There can be no response to something when there is no purpose for something, no intention. One of the things which I've said before, I think, in part of the wider world out there today, one of the biggest problems is, among certainly young people, is the fear of God has left them. They do not have the fear of God. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. And unless you start there, you're going to end in a wrong place. If you don't start in the right place, you end badly in many ways. There's no fear of God before their eyes. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. The fear of the Lord is the fountain of life. By the fear of the Lord, men depart from evil. I don't know how many people keep up with the spokespeople for atheism today, but among those people would be a fellow by the name of P.Z. Myers. And he's one of the supposed intellectuals, brilliant men who defend atheism. I saw him in an interview, and he, in that interview, claimed that he was a fish. Not that he was a fish, but that he is a fish. That was P.Z. Myers. I'm sure that he would scoff at the image of Dagon, who was the seed fish man god, but yet he believes in essence the same thing. Many of you know of Richard Dawkins. I have his book, which some of you perhaps I've read some of it, haven't read all of it, The God Delusion. Interesting book. But I saw him in an interview, and he claimed to be an ape. So P.Z. Myers claims to be a fish. Richard Dawkins claims to be an ape. Probably many of you have seen Neil deGrasse Tyson. He claims to be stardust. And I'm sure that he would scoff at the Greek gods of the constellations. These are all what's known as the new atheist, which are little more than old morphism, as we have seen. And there's what ends in a stolen soul. And they're dragging many, many people along with them with such books as this one. And I forgot I had several, well, other things I brought because I didn't have a PowerPoint. But there's another fellow by the name of Lee Berger who, if you keep up with these kind of things, in 2006 he discovered, well, some of his team discovered a cave in Johannesburg, South Africa, in which there were fossil remains, bones of monkeys that were apparently an extinct kind of monkey. There was this book here, which I got, says Almost Human. And so this is National Geographic, who has been one of the, you know, greatest proponent propagandists of the entire theory of evolution such as since its inception. So he was kissing this when they brought up, and they had a big splash in the news and talked quite a bit about it. I watched the episode, and he in the course of the meeting, he took this skull, which was about the size of my hand, and took it to his mouth and kissed it, and he handed it to other people and they kissed it. It's weird. It's just craziness out there. But they think that they are finding our ancestors in the dirt. And it's just absurd and ridiculous. And Christians are not interested in fables. We don't take heed to fables. These are fables. We do not follow cunningly devised fables. We are interested in what is true. We are interested in reality. We're not interested in fairy tales. We're interested in real science, not pseudoscience. We're interested in real news, not fake news. Evolution is fake news. It is pseudoscience. It is science falsely so-called. Has no truth in it. None. And when Adam, let's take a little bit of a switch change here. I was going to show you this. This was a Time Life book some years back. But this, I know you have seen pictures such as this. I know this is a long ways away. But you've seen pictures like this of a transition from monkey to man. You notice how they're going from dark to light. And the person here at the very end looks like a white European male. I wonder why it is that nobody, it seems to me, ever makes the point that is so obvious to me that public schools and universities are teaching racism. And they're also have an established religion, which is against our Constitution. Evolution is a religion. It is a pagan earth religion. Has no facts related to it. Richard Dawkins can't give me any facts related to it. P.Z. Myers can't. Daniel Dennett can't. Lawrence Krauss can't. Sam Harris can't. And Lee Berger can't. There's no facts that are related to evolution. When Adam looked at and named all the animals that God passed before him, and incidentally, this is the fundamental definition of science, is observation. When you observe something and record it, that's science. You're doing science. It begins with observation. That's what God told Adam to do. So Adam was the first scientist. He told him to name all the animals. In order to name all the animals, he had to observe them. So he observed them and he identified them. He named them. So there was nothing comparable to him, is what he concluded. There was no companion or mate for him. The baboons had a mate. The apes, gorillas had a mate. The chimpanzees had a mate. The baboons had a mate. He didn't have a mate. And that was obvious to Adam. Apparently, it's not that obvious to scientists these days that we are not related to monkeys. Well, why couldn't he find a mate among all those animals that God had created? Well, because God had not created Eve yet. And, of course, Adam was powerless to do anything about it. He didn't know what he was missing until he was shown what he was missing. And Adam did not believe that any one of those apes or monkeys was going to morph into a woman. They all had mates that related to their appearance and their brain and their instinct and their habits. And it was obvious to Adam that there was nothing comparable to him in all of creation. There was nothing attractive to him in all of creation. Certainly, many animals are beautiful to look at, but no animal is beautiful to a man like a woman is beautiful to a man. So there's a huge chasm of difference. Why couldn't Adam find a mate? Because God had not created Eve. And, you know, sometimes I think that we perhaps think that Adam's response to Eve was somewhat cold and analytical. But I would say that when he said, "This is now bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh," it was not cold and analytical. He had 930 years, by the way, to say other things about Eve. But what it was warm and relational. That is that he was saying, this is someone that I can relate to. This is bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh. I can relate to her on an intellectual basis. I can share with her my heart, my body, my all. And he couldn't do that with any of the other animals. So, atheism, evolutionists, agnostics, and other unbelievers apparently can't see that men and women are unique in the world, and that there is no genealogical or heredity relationship between the two. And this is one of the things that I want to tell you that the identity of man is crucial in the way that he thinks about himself. If you believe that your father is an ape, then it has everything to do with how you behave in this world and how you conduct yourself every day. If you believe that, as opposed to believing that you are created different in the image of God. So I sat down the other evening and just started writing down and making a list of the obvious differences and contrast between mankind's nature as compared to any other animal on earth. And so tonight, if you're back, I hope you will be, I'm going to share that list with you. But I'm going to bring this to a conclusion for the moment. Let me just say that most of the similarities that evolutionists try to convince us are part of our heredity that relates to apes and men are structural. In other words, are there a lot of structural similarities between apes and men? Yes, there are. But the reason that there are structural similarities is the same reason that cars all have four wheels and a steering wheel and a gas pedal and a brake pedal and headlights and taillights. Why is that? Why don't some cars have square wheels? Why don't some cars have octagon-shaped wheels? Well, because it'd be a very bumpy ride, for one thing. But it wouldn't work. It's not an optimum design. The reason that there are many similarities between animals is because there are certain optimal designs that work on an earth where there's gravity, where you're breathing the same air, where you're eating the same foods, where you're reproducing in essentially the same ways. So what would be more unusual is if we lived on an earth and everything was completely different. So that wouldn't make any sense. That would be like cars that were completely different. Some had one tire, some had three tires, some had eight tires. That wouldn't make any sense because it's not an optimum design. So anyway, that answers a lot of the questions related to, similarities. But tonight I've got a list of 75 points. And they'll go really fast, that relate to the intellect and the many other differences of man that is not structural. You won't see, for example, a group of apes gathering together, such as we are doing today, and worshiping the God of their creator. You won't see them creating pews and lights and structures like this. You won't see them creating musical instruments and playing them. All a zillion other things that separate human beings from the animal world. And we're going to talk about more of that tonight. If you're a Christian, there's some essential things that you should understand and you can't really miss. And that is that in John 3, Jesus said, I believe it's verse 12, Jesus says, "If I have told you of earthly things and you do not believe, how will you believe if I tell you of heavenly things?" Well, what did, and then in verse in chapter 5, in verse 46 and 47, he says, "You don't believe Moses. If you believe Moses, he said, you would believe me, because he spoke of me. But because you don't believe Moses, you don't believe me." That's what Jesus said. But what did Moses write about? Well, among the many things that Moses wrote about was the creation. Jesus said in answering a question about divorce, he said, in the beginning, this is Mark 10 and Matthew 19, from the beginning of creation, God made them male and female. From the beginning of creation. They didn't morph into something else. They didn't morph from something else. In the beginning, God created them male and female. That's the only way you get humans, by the way. That's the only way you get peacocks, by the way. That's the only way you get butterflies, by the way. Is you have to have male and female. If there was only one butterfly on earth, I would still know that there is a God. That's all I would need. God has given us innumerable testimonies to his creation. The heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament shows his handiwork. Day unto day utter speech, and night unto night shows knowledge. You're here this morning, and I believe number 422, is that right, Dave? We're singing this song. You're here this morning, we can do anything for you to bring you closer to God. Then we're here to do that. And we'll at this time stand and sing this invitation song.